Welcome to the History AI Podcast, where the past comes alive with facts, anecdotes, and a dash of humor. Here are your hosts, Chuck and Marco.
Welcome back to the History AI Podcast, where the past isn't just prologue, it's a roller coaster with swords, scandals, and, sadly today, a lot of sorrow. I'm Chuck.
And I'm Marco. Before we dive in, here's your call to arms, history buffs. If you love what we're doing, hit that subscribe button and leave us a 5-star review. It takes seconds, but it helps us grow this show more than you can imagine.
Seriously, those stars are like historical cannonballs. They carry weight. And the more we have, the better chance we have of blasting through the charts and landing in more earbuds across the world.
Plus, you'll be doing your good deed for the day. You know, preserving history through podcasting. Somewhere a ghostly historian just tipped their hat to you.
Or quill. Ghostly historians definitely write with quills.
Unless it's the ghost of someone from the 80s. Then it's a typewriter.
Anyway, banter aside, this is not an easy episode, folks. We're diving into one of the most tragic and controversial events in American frontier history, the Mountain Meadows Massacre. Be sure to wait after the episode for the original song Blood in the Meadows about today's topic. Let's zoom out for a moment. The year is 1857. The American West is a vast, shifting canvas of conflict, migration, and cultural collision. The California Gold Rush is still sending hopefuls west in droves, settlers are pushing across the Great Plains, and tensions between Native American tribes and white settlers are reaching a breaking point.
At the same time, the U.S. government is struggling to assert control over its rapidly expanding territories. And smack in the middle of all this chaos, Utah Territory, home to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, also known as the Mormons.
The Mormon story is a wild one. Founded in the 1820s by Joseph Smith in upstate New York, the movement quickly gained followers and enemies. After years of persecution, violence, and even murder, Joseph Smith himself was killed by a mob in Illinois. The Mormons, now led by Brigham Young, set out west.
And when we say the West, we mean way west. In 1847, Brigham Young and the first wave of Mormon pioneers arrived in the Salt Lake Valley, which at the time wasn't even part of the United States. It was Mexican territory.
After the U.S. won the Mexican-American War, that all changed. Suddenly, Utah became part of the U.S., but the Mormons didn't exactly roll out the red, white, and blue carpet. They were deeply suspicious of the federal government, and frankly, the feeling was mutual.
Tensions escalated when the Mormons practiced polygamy, a deeply controversial belief at the time, and began setting up what looked like an independent theocracy. Brigham Young was both the governor of Utah Territory and the head of the church. That blurred line between church and state made Washington nervous.
By 1857, President James Buchanan had had enough. Without much evidence of wrongdoing, he sent an army, over 2,500 troops, to Utah to replace Brigham Young with a non-Mormon governor. This became known as the Utah War.
The Mormons saw this as an invasion. They called it Buchanan's blunder and began preparing for war. They stockpiled weapons, reactivated the Nauvoo Legion, a Mormon militia, and invoked martial law. No one was getting in or out of Utah without scrutiny.
Now enter the Baker-Fancher Party. A wagon train of about 120 emigrants from Arkansas, traveling west through Utah on their way to California. Their timing couldn't have been worse. They arrived in southern Utah in early September, right in the middle of paranoia, martial law, and preparations for war.
To make matters worse, rumors spread quickly. The Mormons heard that the emigrants had taunted locals, boasted about past anti-Mormon violence in Missouri and Illinois, and even poisoned a spring. None of this has been definitively proven, but it was enough to stir fear and outrage.
So here we have it, a combustible mix of fear, vengeance, and isolationism. The stage was set for tragedy, and what happened next would haunt American history for generations.
By September 7, 1857, the Baker-Fancher Party had reached a grassy valley known as Mountain Meadows in southern Utah. They were exhausted, low on supplies, and unaware they were being watched.
Early that morning, gunfire erupted from the surrounding hills. The emigrants were under attack. Initially, they believed it was Paiute warriors, but in truth, it was a coordinated ambush led by Mormon militia members, many of them disguised as Native Americans.
the emigrants quickly circled their wagons, digging trenches and using whatever they could to create a makeshift fort. Among them were families, mothers clutching their children, fathers desperately organizing a defense. One witness later described a mother covering her child's ears from the gunfire while sobbing quietly behind a wagon wheel.
They held out for 5 grueling days. They were short on water, and several people had already died. During that time, 2 young men, Alexander Fancher Jr. and William Aiden, snuck out at night, trying to reach help from Cedar City. William made it, barely, but was murdered before he could speak to any authority.
The emigrants finally received a message on September 11th. A group of local Mormon leaders, led by militia commander John D. Lee, approached under a white flag. They claimed they had negotiated a peaceful truce with the Paiutes and offered safe passage back to the main road if the emigrants would lay down their weapons.
Desperate, starving, and betrayed by thirst and fear, the emigrants agreed. They were divided into groups, men first, followed by women and children, each escorted by a Mormon militia member. It was calm. Quiet. Until a prearranged signal, reportedly a shouted command, triggered the horror.
In an instant, the militia turned their guns on the unarmed emigrants. Men were gunned down where they stood. Women screamed and ran, some clutching babies. Children scattered. It was swift, merciless, and almost total.
About 120 people were murdered. Only 17 children under the age of 7 were spared, likely because they were considered too young to remember. They were taken in by local Mormon families. One survivor, little Nancy Dunlap, was just 4 years old. Years later, she recalled waking up in a strange house and crying for her mother.
The brutality of the massacre shocked even some of those who had participated. Diaries and letters later revealed guilt, confusion, and fear of judgment, not just from the government, but from God.
And to this day, that horror remains one of the darkest moments in American frontier history, a betrayal of trust, a manipulation of innocence, and a massacre in the name of mistaken loyalty. After the massacre, a wall of silence descended over Mountain Meadows. Survivors, those 17 children, were too young to testify, and the adults who knew what happened were either dead or sworn to secrecy. For years, the truth was buried under layers of lies, denials, and shifting blame.
The Mormon Church, under Brigham Young's leadership, distanced itself from the massacre. In official correspondence, Young wrote that he learned of the events weeks after they occurred and claimed to have told local leaders not to interfere with emigrant parties. But the federal government didn't buy it.
In fact, in 1859, 2 years later, federal investigator James Henry Carlton visited the site and reported finding human bones scattered across the valley. He was appalled. Carlton's account described small skulls, children's remains, and shredded clothing. The horror hadn't faded. It had just been left to rot.
Meanwhile, the U.S. government began collecting testimonies and slowly building a case. But justice was delayed by years. It wasn't until 1874 that indictments were issued. Most of the original perpetrators had either fled or were protected by the community.
The key figure who was arrested and tried was John D. Lee, the very man who led the militia to the Baker, Fancher party under the white flag. He had been excommunicated from the LDS Church in the years following the massacre, some say as a scapegoat. Others argue he was genuinely complicit and bore heavy responsibility.
Lee's first trial in 1875 ended in a hung jury. The second, in 1876, focused narrowly on his role, not the broader conspiracy. He was convicted and sentenced to death. On March 23, 1877, John D. Lee was taken to the site of the massacre. There, in front of a firing squad and a small audience, he sat on a wooden coffin and read a final statement blaming others, including Brigham Young, before he was executed.
His last words were chilling. "I am a scapegoat for the sins of others." It's a phrase that echoes today in debates about accountability. Was Lee a zealot, a pawn, or both? Historians remain divided.
As for the LDS Church, the Mountain Meadows massacre remained a painful subject. For over a century, there was little acknowledgement. But in recent decades, the church has taken steps to confront its past. In 2007, on the 150th anniversary, LDS leaders expressed profound regret for the massacre and a memorial was erected at the site.
The memorial lists the names of the victims and includes a plaque detailing the event. It doesn't absolve. It doesn't justify. It simply remembers.
And that matters. Because silence, especially after violence, can be its own kind of cruelty.
The Mountain Meadows Massacre remains one of the darkest chapters in Mormon and American history, not just for the act itself, but for how long it took to confront the truth. So Marco, here's what's tough. It wasn't just a massacre. It was also a moment of collective trauma, one that reverberated through generations. This wasn't a random act of violence. It was a calculated, organized execution of innocent people, many of whom were families, traveling together in search of a better life.
Absolutely. And what's even more haunting is the silence that followed. The massacre was so horrific, so overwhelming, that even many of those involved couldn't speak about it. Some confessed in private diaries or deathbed statements, often describing feelings of torment, guilt, and spiritual despair.
And that silence became generational. For decades, families in southern Utah didn't talk about the massacre, not around the dinner table, not at church, not even in whispers. It was a wound that was too dangerous to touch.
On the other side, descendants of the Baker-Fancher party fought to keep the memory alive. Many returned to Mountain Meadows over the years, placing simple stones or wooden markers at the site, often finding that those markers had been removed or destroyed. It wasn't until much later that a permanent monument was allowed.
And then there's the question of reconciliation. The LDS Church officially expressed profound regret in 2007, marking the 150th anniversary. It was a significant step, and church representatives even met with descendants of the victims at the site. But critics pointed out that the word apology was still absent.
Still, something changed. The memorial at Mountain Meadows was expanded. Names of the dead were listed. And researchers, both inside and outside the church, began to publish fuller, more honest accounts of what happened. Transparency became part of the healing process.
But it's a slow healing. Some descendants of the victims say they still feel the weight of injustice. Others have reached out to descendants of the perpetrators to talk, to grieve, even to forgive. It's remarkable to see how people, generations removed, can still feel connected to a single event.
The massacre also serves as a sobering reminder about what fear, extremism, and isolation can lead to. The Mormons weren't inherently violent people. Most were sincere, faith-driven pioneers. But fear turned inward. Faith turned rigid. And in the chaos, something horrifying took root.
That's what makes Mountain Meadows not just a tragedy, but a warning. A warning about what can happen when loyalty to a cause blinds people to their humanity. And when community becomes so closed off that no one dares speak the truth.
History, at its best, doesn't just teach us what happened. It teaches us what could happen again, if we're not careful.
And that's why we remember Mountain Meadows. Not just to mourn the lives lost, but to make sure the silence that followed never returns.
Thank you all for listening. If today's episode moved you or challenged you, please rate us 5 stars, subscribe, and share with your fellow history buffs.
Those reviews help us climb the charts and bring you more stories that matter. Remember, you can suggest topics for future episodes by hitting us up on social media.
And don't forget, all our episodes are evergreen, meaning they're always relevant, always binge-worthy.
We'll catch you next time on the History AI Podcast, powered by the latest AI and fueled by your curiosity.
Stay curious.
September skies in Utah's hills. A wagon train rolled slow and still. Arkansas families westward bound. Dreams of a new life on open ground. Children cried where the prayers of the innocent rose to the the grass where